Hey, it's Josiah. Before we get started with this episode, I have something very special to share with you. You know, we've delved deep into what it means to be an Enneagram 5 together for the past few years, especially with our friend of the show, Sam Greenberg, or as many of you know her, the Enneagram Sexpert. And now we want to go even deeper with you. We've worked together with Sam to craft an online workshop exclusively for Type 5s to help you unlock the secrets of connection with every Enneagram type. This is not just another generic workshop. It's a deep dive into understanding and nurturing relationships tailored specifically for your unique perspective. Imagine getting practical, actionable insights on connecting with each of the 9 Enneagram types, all through the lens of a Type 5. Sam's going to guide you on how to build meaningful relationships, sharing strategies and insights specifically designed for 5s. I've seen firsthand how Sam's insights can transform understanding and communication, and I'm so excited to partner with her to bring this exclusive workshop to you. Whether you're looking to deepen current relationships or navigate new ones, this workshop is a game changer for 5s seeking genuine connection. Spots are limited, and trust me, you don't want to miss this. So head over to Enneagram5.com/connection to secure your place and begin your journey towards richer, more authentic connections. Once again, go to Enneagram5.com/connection or visit the link in the description to get your ticket to the workshop today.
Cody, what do you do when you feel hurt or distressed?
Hurt or distressed?
Emotionally or physically?
Drink.
Accurate.
All right. So my answer to that question is I would like binge watch TV or go down YouTube rabbit holes. Yep.
Take my physical mind. Or emotional distress. Is it the same for both?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
Great. Okay. So neither one of you mentioned anything about seeking help or talking to someone or getting comfort from a person who is human.
Nope.
And that is predictable. And that's what we're here to talk about, I guess. Because I am the same.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if I have strategies exactly, but like the unifying factor when I'm distressed is that I go as far away from everyone else as possible. Hmm.
Yeah, I have to actively fight against that when I'm feeling even remotely balanced or healthy in any way. Like if I get hurt in a place when I'm in a good place in life, then I have to consciously be like, don't shut down, don't shut down, don't shut down. Because I know it's not good. Like consciously, I can separate myself outside of myself and be like, don't do that, you know, but yeah, sometimes it just happens.
So we're talking about attachment styles, which I don't really know anything about. Other than like a 5-minute read before this conversation. Yeah. So
from a therapy session.
Why don't we start with what are attachment styles and we can go from there.
Okay. So attachment theory is technically a theory, but at this point there's been a good amount of empirical research on it. So it's generally accepted as fact at this point. Like if you've been in therapy, probably your therapist has brought it up. So even though it's technically a theory, like it's generally accepted to be true. Based on the work of John Bowlby and then later Mary Ainsworth, there's 4 now, more depending who you ask, but there's 4 main attachment styles: secure, avoidant, anxious, and disorganized. And the way these got started in research is that Mary Ainsworth did a study with young children, like toddler age, and parents, and separated them and then brought them back together. And there's three reactions in her study that the children had to this. The first one for securely attached children was that they would be upset when their parents leave. And then when the parents came back, they would be easily comforted and then they're happy. She said that was about like 60% of the people in the study. I have no idea if that still corresponds to how many people are securely attached, but that's another conversation. And this is just in the original study. This isn't necessarily exactly true now, but the anxious attachment style in this seminal study was children who are like already distressed before the experiment. Then the parents leave, they get really distressed and really stressed. And then the parent comes back and they're hard to soothe. That would be anxious, which she said was about 20%. Then avoidant, which is definitely what we're here to talk about, in my opinion, was children who did not appear distressed upon separation from their caregivers and who avoided contact with them upon their return. So they're basically not showing a lot of emotion about it. And she said that was about 20%. So my personal theory, which is not necessarily backed up by anything, but my personal theory is that most, possibly all, fives are avoidantly attached. And let's explore that.
Okay.
So what that looks like in adults would be really different. So for each of these things it's in adults, you can kind of draw a picture of what it looks like. So I'll at least do secure. So for like a securely attached adult, they're going to be like comfortable with intimacy. They'll have a positive view of self and others. They trust that they're worthy of love. They communicate pretty well openly, and they can need a partner and be independent at the same time. Cody says Madison's a securely attached. So I guess she's the shining example that we know of who's secure attachment. I'll do anxious too, because like the thing that's crazy is that anxious and avoidant people like always end up together. So there's usually anxious avoidant relationships. So anxiously attached adults fear rejection and abandonment. They're what we would probably describe from our position as like needy. They need a lot of reassurance, but then they, once you give it to them, they don't necessarily even trust it. So it's kind of like, you know, this hungry for reassurance thing that happens. They do take a lot of care of others, but they end up feeling resentful about it a lot of times. They're like desperate to be heard and validated, and they really fear abandonment. So that's anxiously attached adults.
For what it's worth, I think that's where Madison was when I met her. So she moved from anxious to secure in her adult life.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And that's something else we can talk about, is if you can change these. And then
there's disorganized too, right?
So I was going to do avoidant next. Disorganized is very hard to explain, but and it's less common. But avoidant is like we'd have a hard time knowing their feelings, or even if they have feelings. They closeness and intimacy can feel uncomfortable or mysterious. They're going to approach emotional problems with logic and reason. Not super skilled at conflict in relationship, and like can be really taken aback by the way conflict happens in relationships. And there's this perception that they don't need attachment at all. Like, I don't need anyone.
I don't know anybody like that.
Me either. Like that.
Okay, we can easily talk about that. So what's disorganized?
Yeah, so disorganized, to round it out, and this is definitely less common, but this is like the inner experience of the person's totally chaotic and confusing, and like they're confused. Arguably, they're kind of ping-ponging between anxious and avoidant. They'll like pull you in, push you away, pull you in, needy, avoidant kind of thing. They tend to have a negative self-image, and their behaviors are very unpredictable. Their relationship behaviors tend to be unpredictable. So that's typically people who have the most trauma or like complex PTSD and stuff will have disorganized attachment.
Definitely known people like that.
Yeah, it's really difficult to have a relationship with a disorganized attachment person.
Yes, it is.
Okay, so I'm really curious then, like, what is the thinking behind how much of this is nature versus nurture? Like, is it entirely dependent on like how you were raised and your relationship with your caregivers, or what's the thinking behind this?
That is a great question. I have a sense of it, but I'm basically talking out of my ass because this isn't my area of expertise. I believe it's almost entirely nurture.
Okay.
At this point, scientists are reluctant to say anything is 100% nature or nurture, because it seems to be like all combo. But I believe with attachment, it has everything to do with how you were treated as a baby, as a young child. Where, for example, anxious attachment is believed to be created by caregivers that are present and see you, you know, in tune with you, attuned to you sometimes, and then other times totally gone. So it's unpredictable. And that creates this like needy, clingy pattern of like, I know what it feels like to have what I need, but I can't predict when I'll have it. Whereas avoidant is thought to be created by essentially like inconsistently or very rarely or never having that kind of attunement you needed, so that you form this attachment style where you're like, well, I don't even need attachment, and attachment is in fact maybe a threat.
So if it's mostly nurture, then what's behind your theory that pretty much all fives are avoidant?
Well, the theory of nature nurture with Enneagram is like ever shifting. But I kind of came up in the school of thought that Enneagram type is nurture based.
Really?
I was going to ask you that question. Yeah, if you thought that it was nurture based, because that's the only way you could support this theory.
Right, exactly. So yeah. I don't think it's 100% nurture, but I mean, now they're like, people are swinging more towards it. You were born with your type, and I don't really exactly think that. I think, you know, fives, there's a lot of theory about invasive caregivers or absent caregivers creating the type five structure. And I forget if you've done an episode on this, but if you talk to fives, usually they're like, my parents were either 100% not there or completely invasive to the point that like they weren't seeing me, but they were constantly in my face and like poking me and prodding me, or one of each. And that seems to be something fives have in common. So I tend to think the type structure is nurture, attachment styles nurture, and they seem to be very related.
Yeah. I mean, I could accept that, I think. Because, yeah, I think my parents were like that. My parents were kind of, one was like all in my business all the time, but then didn't necessarily like see or understand me. And then my dad, who's also a five and had parents that, from what I can tell, were pretty absent. Both of them were. So he was. And so it was definitely like that back and forth kind of situation. So, you know, it kind of makes sense. Yeah, it's at least been my life.
Yeah.
Very similar with me.
Yeah. I've described like growing up, my house was kind of like growing up in a hotel, because especially when, you know, by the time we got to be teenagers, it was like we all just came and went and we rarely had a meal together. And wasn't a sense of, you know, family bonding or activities. Everyone just kind of did their own thing. And my parents were not very involved in my life. My mom, like, more so, because she was very nurturing by nature, but she, you know, she had her own issues that she was dealing with that kind of caused separation with the people around her. So I definitely felt very alone most of the time I was growing up.
I have to admit, I'm mostly avoidant, dismissive. And it's just kind of the way things have naturally developed over time. My long-term relationships are not the best. I have to really be comfortable with people before I really let them into my life. I'm not a fan of criticism. I don't know who is. And it is really difficult for me to rely on others. I want to be independent. I don't like having to always meet somebody else's needs. I'm not a fan of clingy people at all. But I also want myself to be open to people if they need me. But it has to be a known need, an actual need. I know some of that is because I want to protect myself from being hurt, from being vulnerable. I know that enough about myself. And in relationships, well, I mean, if it helps, I've never been married. I'm still single and I'm in my 50s. I've had a couple of serious relationships in my life, but not many. And at this point in my life, I'm kind of comfortable being by myself, but it is nice to have people to talk to and have friendships that are good friendships. But I haven't really been enamored with really, really deep relationships, not as much as I used to be. I like having people I can talk to the depths of me with, but I'm not comfortable with giving that to just anyone. So it would have to be a pretty special person for me to have a really deep relationship with.
Have you said what type your mom is before? Do you know?
I don't know. I don't know. It's hard to tell because, I mean, if I were to guess, I would say she was probably a two, but she grew up religious, so it's hard to know if she's actually a two or if she's, you know, conditioned as a two.
Yeah,
I have no idea.
My mom's a four. My dad's a five.
Just curious.
Yeah. Yeah. What about you? What are your parents?
My mom's a seven and my dad's a five. And my mom's an anxiously attached seven. So like all the buzziness of the seven, like the short attention span and the like kind of consuming thing that sevens have, but with a lot of like neediness involved with it.
So like super into your business and all about it, but like for their need, not for yours.
Exactly. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. You put it perfectly.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's definitely, I kind of forgot about the attachment styles. I touched on this briefly in a therapy session and I took the test and I remember getting it and being like, I failed this test. Getting my answer and being like, oh no, this ain't good. Oh, damn it. That doesn't sound good at all. But then it started making a whole lot of sense. And so it was definitely very, very helpful in at least in the very brief exposure that I've had to it, had with it. And so, yeah, I can see how it definitely can start the conversation with relationships in your life and hopefully in the right direction.
So some shining, hilarious examples of pig voidantly attached from my own life.
Yeah.
Two different times in the past 4 years or 5 years, I'll say, I've been like about to faint, like just like about to pass out when I was with human people who I knew who could help me. I got up and went as far away from them as possible.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
As far away from every human as possible.
Yeah. Right.
Like, what the fuck? Like, to just go die in the woods? I don't know, but like...
I was gonna say, it's like a dog when they're like dying and they go away from everybody.
Every time I act like this, I'm like, this is weird. Like, the only time you would see this in nature is like if there's a diseased animal and wants to go die alone. What was I thinking? But like literally one time, both times I didn't end up fainting, but the one time I was like at a restaurant, I kind of like slid down the wall in the hallway and a busboy found me. Like, seriously, makes no sense. But when I'm in trouble, like of any real kind, and like I have to get the fuck away, like from everyone, all that will happen is that they'll make it worse.
Yeah.
And that's like, that's the epitome of avoidant attachment. If you're in distress and your inclination is to not get help, that's avoidant attachment.
And not just to not get help, but like to actively push away anyone who might help. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm definitely like that. I've had the exact same situation where I passed out, but I went to the bathroom and passed out with the door locked by myself and had a full on seizure in the floor and then had to try to explain what happened to my parents afterwards. But yeah, totally had that happen.
I know, and it's so scary to other people who love you, understandably, because as I'm hearing Cody, who I relate to a lot as a human, say this story, I'm like, Cody, what were you thinking? But yeah. I did the same thing. It's not really safe behavior, but it feels in the moment like the only thing that will save you.
It'll be our demise in the end.
We're going to die alone. In a bathroom.
It's possible.
It's definitely possible, yeah. Man, yeah, I'm trying to think. I know that this has definitely shown up. Well, you were talking about how, like, avoidant attachment, people coming, like, parents coming home and you not, like, caring or getting excited about that or whatever. That still shows up in my life. Madison gets so mad when she comes home and I don't acknowledge her. Like, I just am, I'm doing my own thing and I'm thinking about something else, and like, and she takes it so personally, and I'm like, I'm glad you're home, like, I just didn't think about it. So I guess that's part of that same behavior. But yeah, because she loved, like, every time I come home, she immediately acknowledges me and is so happy I'm home.
I used to describe Amy as like a puppy when I would get home, because she's just like so happy and excited. And I'm just like, what the fuck is happening? I just got off work. I'm super stressed. I'm like, can you give me a minute, please?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm exactly the same way.
Yeah. And it's weird too. Like, as we're talking through this, I can see how even with my kids, who are fairly close together in age, like there's only 2 years between the three, like each of them. And I think they have different attachment styles.
How can you tell? Like, tell us more.
Because when I am leaving, the oldest and the youngest, they hear the door open, or like they know that I'm leaving, and they'll run. And I think the youngest is really copying the oldest, because he's still pretty young. He's three. And they will, like, you know, like, hey, I got to give you a hug. I got to give you a kiss. And then when I get home, it's like immediately running out and running up to me. And then my middle one, he used to be more like that when he was younger, but he is now, like, I have to ask him to come give me a hug and a kiss. And when I get home, I have to go like seek him out most of the time to give him a hug and a kiss, like when I get home. And there's a very noticeable difference between them.
Yeah. He never says bye to me either.
He doesn't like goodbyes. Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Wonder why that is.
So in theory, like, I would expect it to be a little different with birth order, though. But in theory, if you became a better parent over time, like, your older kids might have more avoidant or anxious styles and your younger kids might have more secure styles. But also, like, maybe this does have to do with how you're born as well. I really don't know.
Well, yeah, maybe this is a good example of
that. There's also, I mean, it could also have to do with, like, the years in which you experience, you know, the different parenting, because his very formative years were during the pandemic, and there was so much stress and anxiety in our household during that, you know, that time period. 'Cause he was two in 2020. And so, and there was a noticeable difference after 2020 with him. And so maybe that's part of it, just like that stage of development that you experience different things. I don't know.
That's a great point. Well, if a child experiences, like, its parents are very stressed out, that would affect this for sure.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually. Contextually, that's very interesting. It's crazy how much 2020 affected all of us, I guess. Mm-hmm. Created a whole different attachment style in one of your kids.
I can definitely attest to the fact that I am a very different parent now than I was, you know, 6 years ago, 7 years ago when my first one was born. I would like to think I'm a better parent. Actually, I can objectively say I'm a better parent because I'm a better human being. But there were times where it was a roller coaster, just the things that I was going through. And I'm sure that there were times when it felt like I was really accessible and really engaged. And then there are times when I was really distant. And I'm sure that affected them in different ways, kind of probably depending on, one, their
personality, but also just the stage of life that they were in when that was happening.
Yeah.
That makes sense. There's also now some theory on two different types of avoidant attachment. And I know less about this, but there's dismissive avoidant and then fearful avoidant. And the dismissive avoidant would be more like positive view of self, negative view of others. And they would place great importance on self-sufficiency, having lots of space. And they would be the more classic, like avoid all attachment, which sounds closer to like what we're all saying. Whereas the fearful avoidant would be more of like a fluctuating view of self and others. That's like fear driven. Like I'm avoiding attachment because I'm afraid of getting hurt. But I actually do want intimacy, crave intimacy, which feels like a little less familiar, at least to me.
Yeah.
But I guess there's shades of avoidant attachment as well.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I'm definitely dismissive avoidant for sure. No question.
Yeah, same.
I was never really afraid of getting hurt. That was never a driving factor for me in terms of connection with others.
Yeah,
it was same. Just the burden of it.
Okay, so Sam, since you are a relationships expert, I'm really curious to get your take on how this shows up in relationships, especially as a five, and maybe you can talk through some of the other types as well.
Okay, sure. So first, like before getting to technical stuff, I think just from our experience, our collective experience, like what have your partners complained about? And probably it's avoidant attachment traits for all of us.
Yeah.
I'll go first. So across my life, people get really hurt about the fact that I don't tell them when I'm in distress and they don't know things about major, extremely large life events that were painful to me until years after, and how much that shuts them out. And that's sort of my earlier life behavior. And then like my current partner complains about me isolating, you know, avoiding. If I'm distressed, I have a hard time formulating like my feelings because I don't even know what they are. That's a kind of a problem. So those would be my highlight complaints.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to those. Because I mean, you could I can take those and then add to it and say, we've talked about it before, just like remembering to show affection and quality time, not being just existing together in the same room and then checking that box and moving on. Right. I think that's something that I'm definitely guilty of and get complaints of a lot. And feeling like even after that, I need my own time and space again. When it wasn't even really great connection to begin with. Sometimes I have to pull myself out of that a little bit, but that's definitely like biggest complaints as of late, I think, has been things along that line. That and like I said, not getting excited when she comes home or even acknowledging that she came home.
Yeah, I think for me, a lot of that same stuff too. When I'm upset, when I'm having a bad day, my first instinct is to like hold myself up somewhere and try to distract myself from it until I start feeling better. It is so hard for me to send Amy a text and be like, "Man, I had a bad day. I don't like that feeling." And it's gotten a lot better. Like I've started to make a habit of doing that sort of thing because I need to, you know, and that's part of having a relationship and stuff. But on the other side too, because my default is that, that's also my expectation of others. And so I don't want to speak for Amy. I will say that because I don't know where she would fall now, but definitely earlier in our relationship, very much anxious attachment. And she would rely on me to help be emotional support. And it felt like a burden because my expectation was like, you should go off on your own and handle that yourself because that's what I do. why are you asking me for this? You know, and at my core, like, that's not really how I felt, but that's my sort of like initial response or my reaction, which then makes it, you know, makes her feel like she's a burden, which is not a good place to be. So I can definitely see how this has shown up and negatively affected our relationship in a lot of ways in the past, especially.
That's still a huge problem for me. Like, when someone is acting what I perceive to be whiny, I'm like, it's an extremely large turnoff in terms of me wanting to help them. And I'm actively working on this because it's not cool. Like, it's not fair. But the idea is, like, I never burdened anyone with my needs for my entire existence. So why do I deserve to have to, like, output a bunch of energy to help people who are burdening me with their needs?
Yeah. That this topic has actually already shown up in another episode that Josiah and I have had, where I was talking about when somebody continually does the same thing and then wants to come and complain to me about it, even though, like, they've been presented with the solution. And I'm just like, I want to write them off as people. And I'm like, what the hell you think? You're bad at living right now. Like, you had solutions and you didn't do it. I don't want to hear your sob story anymore. I'm done with this. And I'm so guilty of just like being done with it. I just don't want to hear about it anymore. You hate your job. Everything about it sucks. It stresses you out. And yet you won't find a new one because, this is what I wanted to do. You know, it's just so hard here. I'm like, well, okay, then you deserve this bad job that's driving you insane.
Empathy problems.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Definitely been guilty of that sort of thing, where it's like there have been people in my life that make really terrible relationship decisions. And I would tell them, I'm not talking about you specifically, Cody, in this.
The Even fact that he says that, I feel like, is telling. Why did he say that he's not talking
about
you?
Because
I was thinking it was me.
Because I just gave a best man speech at his wedding where I roasted him. And I started with how terrible relationship decisions he's made.
I see.
But it's like, you know, I can tell them, and multiple people tell them, this is a terrible decision and this person is not right for you and you're going to end up in a terrible situation because of this. And it keeps, and then the exact thing like plays out and there are repercussions. And it is so hard for me to not just be like, you know, just wash my hands and say, well, look, we told you, this is what you get. This is what, you know, these are the consequences. Go deal with them. Like, you know, you're not getting any help from me because if you'd have listened to me, we could have avoided this whole situation. Yeah. That's real bad.
We had that happen recently in one of our friend groups. Two different people who make terrible relationship decisions on their own decided to date each other.
Yeah.
And we told both of them, you should not do this. You're going to make each other miserable. And we're going to have to sit and watch the whole thing as it unfolds and affects different social gatherings and stuff like that. They wouldn't listen. And then it did do that. And when it did, when shit started to hit the fan, guess what I did? Nothing. Didn't want to hear about it. Didn't want to be around it. Like, basically wrote them off and was like, until you guys figure your shit out, I'm not hanging out with you at all. Because I told you this was going to happen.
Hey, it's Josiah. Just want to take a quick break from this episode to remind you about our upcoming online workshop with Sam. Let me tell you, this is not your average workshop. It's a focused deep dive into building stronger connections across all Enneagram types, with practical insights and strategies tailored specifically for fives. Whether you're aiming to enhance your current relationships or forge new ones, this workshop is your ticket to deeper, more meaningful connection. Spaces are filling up fast, so don't miss out. Visit Enneagram5.com/connection to join us and start transforming your relationships today. Once again, go to Enneagram5.com/connection or visit the link in the description. Now back to the episode.
So we're all relating really hard right now. I love the camaraderie, but also this is not healthy behavior from us.
It's really not. No.
No, definitely not. No, I can acknowledge that for sure.
I forget that because I really want to feel seen. And there's not a lot of people that I know who are like this. But I think if we were less avoidantly attached ourselves, we would be less inclined to be like, go figure your fucking shit out in a corner. Go faint in a corner like we do. Like, that's, it's not cool.
So, Sam, earlier you mentioned that anxious and avoidant types often find each other. Why is that?
Yes. It seems to be like the most common pairing of attachment styles, which is really interesting. I think the reason is like the anxious people feel like incapable or lost, or they need like something stable. To them, avoidant attachment people appear really stable.
Because like they're the appearance of independence, maybe.
Yeah, like we aren't having these big mood swings. We aren't seeming like we have these needy, clingy like issues.
When you're not in a relationship with us, we seem really put together.
It's true. Yeah.
Totally. Oh my God, can we make a t-shirt that says that? Can that be like the group t-shirt? Until you're in an intimate relationship, we seem really put together. But we're not. So that's, I think, why anxious is drawn to avoidant, the kind of like pseudo-stability thing. And then the avoidant folks, we can get like a little bit enamored with the anxious person's emotional expressiveness, their kind of seeming depth, their ability to express themselves. Like, we lack that. And it seems really exciting. It seems like something we would want to learn. So I think we can get attracted to that. And then it's a little bit of a bait and switch thing, because avoidant people are not actually stable. We're just avoidant. The breakdown is happening behind the wall, so you don't see it, but we're not stable. It's pseudo-stability. And then for us, like, if we're attracted to an anxious person, the bait and switch is like, they're not necessarily emotionally expressive and deep. It's like pseudo-depth. Like, it's their neediness, what you could call like the hungry ghost that they have, this like desire for something that's never enough. That's what's making it look like they have all this emotional expressiveness. And in fact, it's just anxiety. So then you get your anxious avoidant relationships, which can have, you know, the negative cycles of reinforcing each other kind of thing. Like, if you imagine what Cody was saying about Madison's like, why don't you acknowledge my existence? Like, you would have the anxious person being like, hey, like, why aren't you treating me like I'm important? And the avoidant person would be like, I do treat you like you're important. And then the anxious person's like, no, you need to do X, Y, and Z. And the avoidant person's like, that's, you're asking too much. And it just like goes around and around forever. That's kind of what you can get stuck in those relationships and at their worst.
Yeah.
You just described like the first half of my marriage. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of my teenage relationships, for sure. Like early 20s and like beginning of adulthood. Yeah. A lot of relationships in that part of my life was basically that. Oh, yeah. It was so bad. Cause we just literally, it is a constant cycle. There's no way out of it.
Based on my deep 5-minute online research, looks like my attachment style is the disorganized one. When single, it looks more like the anxious one. I crave a connection, a bond, to have someone next to me. When in a relationship though, it switches to the avoidant one. I feel like the bond itself is enough. I don't take care of it, have problems with the trust, don't share my feelings, stay closed. Which usually is detrimental for the relationship. As a 5, I highly resonate with a few points from the description of the disorganized attachment style too. Things like having difficulties with opening up to their loved ones, reporting that they don't feel anything or have emotions, experiencing difficulties with trusting others with their feelings, deciding not to show outward expressions of emotions. All that sounds quite Fiverr in my opinion.
You had mentioned there was some research between attachment style and the Enneagram. I'm curious what that is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that at the beginning because we are here just speculating, but there is one study that was performed on the overlap between the Enneagram and attachment theory. And it's not like so earth-shattering. They didn't map every single type to every single attachment style or anything. But what they did was they hypothesized that there's more avoidant Enneagram types and less avoidant. And the ones they found, they hypothesized were more avoidant is 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And then less avoidant was the other ones. And they did find support for that. And then they also hypothesized there's types that are higher in anxiety, so like closer to anxious, which would be 2, 4, 6, and also 9. Interesting. Mm-hmm. 9's both, I guess. So
9 is all things to all people.
It's true.
I was going to say that.
9 is whatever that you want them to be.
Universal mirror.
Yeah.
So basically, it's like really preliminary stuff, and this is an older study from 2010, but they found initial support for the idea that types would exhibit attachment style, like same attachment style within every one of the same type. And then I would think that people would have followed up on that research and done more, but no one has.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And yeah, you would think more people would study it simply because the Enneagram is so much more popular now and so much more part of just like culture and a lot of, and even maybe even like more mainstream pop culture. It's kind of bled into that with all the Instagram accounts and everything. Like it's so many memes and people getting into it. I would think that there would be a lot more.
Attachment style is really blown up too. Like there's a lot of, by the way, I took a lot of this information from the Secure Relationship Instagram account, which is really good if you want to follow that. So I'm surprised too, total separate soapbox, but the amount of research on the Enneagram is like shocking how little there is. Mm. And compared to a whole bunch of these other concepts like attachment style, which has a lot more. And I think it's because people are just intimidated to do it with a concept that's a little bit squishy, like it's a little amorphous. It's hard to pin down scientifically.
A little too fluid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that is really interesting. I mean, I don't know if different personality types, obviously it doesn't have to be like a blanket statement, but it is, I don't know if I've ever known a 5 who didn't have an avoidant attachment of some sort. Like when I really think about it, it's like, it's almost like there's a Venn diagram of the defining characteristics of a 5 and avoidant attachment that it's there in the middle. Like it's just that list. So,
exactly. So if we sort of follow that line of thinking, then if everyone was a good parent, 5s wouldn't exist.
Yes.
I had that thought earlier and I almost said it. I was thinking if it's really all like nurture, then 5s are the byproduct of bad parenting.
But actually, so were a lot of types. Like I haven't really met many 4s who aren't anxiously attached. There's some who are avoidant. So I don't know. But I think it's like bad parenting has created a lot of these things.
Well, and it's weird too, because like 6s, you know, Madison's a 6 and I've known a lot of 6s and they're all pretty much the same in terms of like, I hate to like lean on stereotypes with different personality types, but with 6s, they tend to just be more anxious and especially in less, maybe in lower levels of development. But I think that, but like Madison came from pretty stable, but very loving and nurturing parents. And so it's interesting that like a 6 would come from that, like somebody who could develop such anxious behaviors would come from such a loving and I would say fairly consistent and stable home. For me, it's easy for me to pinpoint certain behaviors from my parents and grandparents and all the way through all of my family being very similar. That's why me and my brother are both the same personality type and are kind of opposite sides of the same coin within fiveness, I think. And so that makes perfect sense to me. I think the fives, I think I actually, maybe I, for now, at least I believe that statement. Fives are a byproduct of bad parenting, I think, or like maybe not bad parenting, but lack thereof of things that should have been there, that should have been more nurturing behaviors, probably.
I tend to think, and I guess this is a little controversial here, like I lean towards more towards nature being a more heavily influenced for the Enneagram, the nurture personally.
How do you think that plays out though?
Like, if we're just talking about like attachment styles, like we talked about, mm-hmm. like I look at my family and like I'm one of five and we had the same parents and yeah, different phases, but like they were pretty consistent for most of us. And we have very different personalities across that spectrum. And I know that birth order is affecting that. I know that like, you know, different things,
even different time periods, yeah. like what you experience.
Yeah. And so it's really hard to say, but I also, I don't know. I tend to lean a little more esoteric in some of my thoughts on the Enneagram anyway. So, we can get into that another time.
Attachment style though, I feel like you and your siblings just from the little, I mean, I know I've known your siblings for in different capacities throughout the years since I've known you, but like in little bits and pieces, I could see similar attachment styles between all of you though. Mm-hmm. No, you don't think so? Except mm-hmm. for maybe like the youngest of your siblings.
No, we definitely have a mixture of anxious and avoidant.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Yeah. I think anxious and avoidant can come out of the same household, right? I mean, Sam, would you say that?
Like, but what I'm saying is like, it's not like a progression. I mean, I don't want to call out my siblings on this.
Yeah, no, I mean, we're talking about family dynamics, right? Like, it's just a general thing. But I mean, like, yeah, no personality is the same, like, in any way. No brain is the same. So you're not going to perceive it. Two different people would perceive the same situation differently. So like there's that at play,
which is why I think it's more of it sort of starts with a foundation of nature and then your nature helps influence how you respond to things.
Two things or possibly three things.
Sam's about to like give me a smackdown.
No, not at all. No, I'm really incorporating your perspective, actually. One is it would be more rare to find secure and insecure attachment in the same family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It would be more common to see different types of insecure attachment within the same family. So like Cody said, anxious and avoidant kids and siblings, that makes sense because sometimes the parents were there, sometimes they weren't. But the nature part could be that like, were born more susceptible to not being seen or less. So if they were like inconsistently there for you, Josiah, you end up avoidant, but some of your siblings end up anxious. Like in theory, anxious is kind of one better, don't get mad, than avoidant. And like if we talk about moving to secure, we would have to move through anxious attachment before we got to secure.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting.
I kind of thought that because I was thinking about it in terms of just like looking at a list of how they've organized them and how you went through them. It sounds like levels of health or like kind of development throughout, just similar to how you have in the Enneagram within each type, right? So it's like you move up and down on like a ladder, I would guess.
That's not necessarily how everyone sees it. But when we talk about how to heal, it is kind of like you move through them. So I think it is possible.
Yeah, let's talk about that then. So what do we do? How do we go on this journey?
Great, because I forgot the other thing I was going to say anyway. It's really hard. And as far as I understand, one can change their attachment from insecure to secure with a lot of self-work. But how do you do that is the question. So for an avoidant person, it would be a lot about letting your guard down and kind of like exposure therapy, where, for example, we would make ourselves tell someone when we're in distress in the moment or work up to it. Tell them 5 minutes after instead of a year after then
like an accountability partner.
Yeah. Then work up to being able to tell someone in the moment and let them help you. That's probably the biggest thing. And what you'll find, though, and this is what I think stalls a lot of people's progress, is as you do that, you become more anxious and you start to feel these feelings that anxious attachment people feel, which is like, oh God, I finally formed an attachment. What if it goes away?
Oh, fuck.
It's horrible.
Yeah, I get that for sure. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, it's like intolerable, basically. And then you have to sit through all of that pain and then work your way all the way through anxious attachment before you can maybe get to secure. And you can probably tell from how I'm talking that I'm only like towards the beginning of this process because I can't even describe the rest of it. I definitely personally worked a lot to get from totally avoidant to on the edge of anxious.
Anxious avoidant.
And even that only with, you know, my husband, not with everyone, not with friends, like with one person. Right. So it's yeah. really hard and it's like really incremental and it's all this like doing stuff you don't want to do. You can kind of look inward and be like, is this the opposite of what I want to do? Then I should do it. And that's very, very hard to motivate.
Yeah. I say accountability partner a minute ago because like I always hated that term and never wanted, I never, especially when I was in religious circles, like anything remotely accountability, I was like, no, fuck that. Like that's nobody gets it within my walls like that. Like where it's like a dutiful thing. And cause then it just feels like they're judging you. Right. And they're like, that doesn't necessarily mean that has to be that way. I was thinking about like a positive way that type of relationship could look is like, finding somebody who understands that when you do tell them something about your feelings or as a five, you know, I'm just thinking about it. Like if I were to have somebody that I was like designating to try to practice this behavior and say, okay, whenever I'm having a bad day or I'm feeling really stressed out or just literally anything, I'm going to tell you this. And I need you to just be like, thank you for telling me. And move on just for at least the first little bit. Right. Yeah. Like I'm not going to want them to tell me how to fix it. I don't want them to like get involved. I just need them to be that sounding board at first so they can receive the information and acknowledge that they received it and that they were thankful for it and then move on so that I start like rewiring my brain to be a positive experience. I feel like that may be the easiest way for me to start doing something like that for sure.
I saved a post from the secure relationship that says 4 tips to help your avoidant partner feel safe. And the first one is exactly what you just said. It says, meet them where they are. Nobody goes from being emotionally in touch with themselves and their partner overnight. So if your partner says something like, I feel sad, you might not be used to talking about feelings at all. Just say, I really appreciate you letting me know. And it helps me feel connected to you. Like, don't push it. Don't try to go into it. Just thank them. So I feel like that really reflects what you're saying.
Yeah. So for all the people that may listen to this podcast who aren't fives, this is for you.
Yeah. I mean, Amy has done that at different times. And I always really appreciate that because then I feel like it's safe to continue to do that in the future. Where I can let someone in. I can sort of control the amount that I let them in or have more control over the amount that I let them in because that is part of the fear is that if I open up a little bit, then I have to open up more than I'm ready.
It's got
to
be like a floodgate.
Yeah. Then. And so then I just don't want to open up at all. And I've been practicing this a lot, actually, especially since this summer. And for me, it's been like different areas I'm more comfortable with. Like if I'm like having a bad day at work, it's a lot easier for me to say that than certain other areas of my life that feel more intimate. And so it's just, there's a spectrum there. But one thing that I've been practicing since this summer is like just not making that distinction. And anytime I'm feeling, you know, distressed or upset or lonely, anything like that, reaching out to Amy and letting her know. And that has been really hard. But it's also been really great because amazing things have come out of that. Our relationship since the summer especially has been it feels just like on a rocket ship. And a big part of that is because I've stopped detaching, you know, I've stopped avoiding all of that. And I've let myself, I guess, feel the anxiety. Now we're viewing it through this lens. I can totally see that, because there is, yeah. when you pull away that avoidance, there's very much a, I can't attach to you, because if the moment that I let myself feel happy, it's all going to get taken away. And that is a story that since the summer that we've talked about in the connection episode, like that has been a journey for me of interfacing with that, confronting that whole story and working through that and processing it and learning how to move past it.
Well, in retrospect too, now that you're saying that out loud, I mean, that's definitely directly, I think you practicing that behavior directly impacted this season of the podcast.
Yep.
Because you think going back and listening to all the conversations that we've had for this season has definitely, I look back on that and it's like the kind of like the raw feed of your feelings and thoughts this season that has kind of fueled the conversation and pulled me out of my shell a little more. And we've gotten into like some pretty intense and deep topics, more so than the last three seasons, I think. There is a certain like vulnerability and rawness to this season that I think has been directly influenced by that particular behavior. And the fact that I think we both have wanted, you know, to go there as well. And so, and it's cool to hear Sam that you're also like trying to move through that. Like we're all doing it together, but separate. But I've talked about in the past about my whole death anxiety. Looking at that, that's directly fueled by like, I wouldn't have felt, I don't think that whole deconstructing of what the concept of death is outside of religion and everything that I went through with that and how that had so impacted like my songs on my new project and stuff like that. I don't think that would have happened had I not been in such a secure feeling relationship for the first time in my life. Where it's like suddenly I had something to lose, therefore I feared death in a different way.
Yeah.
And if nothing happens after we die, then like, and this is it, I don't want to lose that thing. And so like that anxiety caused me an intense amount of grief for about 7 straight months of just awful anxiety that penetrated my thoughts multiple, like hundreds of times a day. Like it was awful. And so... yeah, and having to learn to sit with that. So I completely relate to that to some degree, for sure.
Just wait till you have kids, man.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. I really can't.
Okay, wow. So the answer, as usual, I feel like for us, is do the shit you don't want to do.
Yeah.
And face
Run
your fears.
Run towards the shit you don't want to do.
Run into the burning building.
It does feel like you're gonna die if you do it. I mean, these are adaptations that we have for a reason that helped us survive at some point. And yeah. At least for me, and this stuff comes up a lot with my kids where like something's kind of going wrong and people are looking, I feel very unsafe, which is not good. Like as a parent, like if my kid like busted his mouth open and he was bleeding everywhere and there's like people around and I basically told them to go away, like that's not good for him. Like he's not getting the most help if I do that. That's a real story, by the way. So like when that happens, like I feel like I will die if people are near me. Mm. And like I just have to get over it and do it anyway.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
We don't have to start by running into the burning building, though. Like, that's the good thing. I think the first step is awareness, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why I'm really glad that we've had this conversation. Because this is not a lens through which I had, you know, viewed things before. It wasn't a tool. And so now I have this to also help me be more aware of my attachment style and how that's showing up. And I can definitely see how it has affected me in the past, but I can also see how I've grown a lot. And so, yeah, thank you, Sam, for walking us through everything.
Of course. And I definitely, like, I'm not a super expert on this. So do your own research, everyone who's listening. But it is helpful. And Josiah, you're right that if, like, the first step of any change really is witness. So start looking for this in your life and you're going to see the footprints of it everywhere probably.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been an excellent conversation as always. And until next time.
See you later.
Bye.
Hey, it's Josiah, and I wanted to say thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this episode and you're the type of person who likes helping others, would you do us a favor and share it with other people like you? If you found value in this conversation, they will too. I also want to give a special thanks to our community members who shared their voice with us in this episode. If anything in this conversation has resonated with you, or if you have any further thoughts or questions, I want to invite you to join our community of other people like you and continue the conversation at enneagram5.com.